Rachel Lavie, Reel One. That is how you pronounce
actually,
your name.
Sorry, I should have said it's Larvey.
Larvey.
Yes.
Rachel, yeah, otherwise it sounds Rachel.
I know.
Rachel
Larvey. I'm quite used to it from school.
Reel One, I bet. Rachel, could I ask you first of all about your background, you know, whereabouts you were born and brought up, and something about the lifestyle of your family?
Yes. Well, I was actually born in Uganda, in fact. So that may have had some influence on my desires to travel. My father was a doctor and he was working in a small hospital in Kampala when Uganda was still a British protectorate. And I've got six brothers and sisters. So I come from a large family, which again, I think, gave me a sort of love of being with people. but I don't remember very much about Uganda. We came home when I was three and I went to school and grew up in this country, in Tunbridge Wells, in Kent. As I say, I had a big family, so there were always plenty of people around, and I think big families often attract other people too, so we had a large house, a large garden, and lots of friends always coming round. And I think that made me quite an outgoing, sociable person, and a team person, a person who liked to live and work and be amongst other people.
Presumably, when your father was working in Uganda, your family were there. This must have been the time of troubles, wasn't it?
Well, in fact, it was the early 60s, so Uganda was reasonably stable then. Obote was the president. It was before Amin came, and we left just about the time that Amin was coming up into power. In fact, when we were back in England, things really flared up in Uganda, and I kept a close listen on the news as to what was going on. So I suppose I perhaps had an interest right back then into conflict, although I didn't realise it at the time. Uganda was the place of my birth and a country which has always been on my heart. And I think often people who are born and brought up in East Africa, or anywhere in the world, but I meet many people who are born and brought up in East Africa and want to go back.
How about your education?
I went to a grammar school in Tunbridge Wells, a girls' grammar school. But I got lots of brothers. I have four brothers, so it didn't really affect me, I don't think, adversely going to an all-girls school. In fact, I think it was quite good because you just concentrated on work. Not that I was very academic at all. And I regret that partly now because I just wanted to be a nurse. And I think I wanted to be a nurse because my mother was a nurse. And I never really questioned or thought, why do I want to be a nurse or what do nurses actually do? My father was a surgeon and we became a rather sort of stereotyped family in that three of my four brothers did medicine and myself and my elder sister went into nursing. So the boys followed Dad and the girls followed Mum. And I don't really know why I did that. But as I say, now with hindsight, I'm very glad because of what my nursing qualifications have led me on to. But there were times when I was in my earlier 20s, when I was nursing perhaps, that I began to feel, why on earth didn't I work at school and do science subjects and then I could have done medicine? Inevitably there was a feeling like that and I was a bit sort of jealous of my brothers. But I didn't work at school, I just had a nice time. I mean, I was pretty averagely in the middle of a grammar school and I could have done a lot better, that was the usual. But it was a happy time and a very happy childhood, and I think partly the reason I didn't work was because there was so much else going on. I liked tennis, I liked swimming, I liked lots of sports, all sorts of social activities and things that went on. We had a very nice home with a swimming pool and a tennis court, and I guess I was a bit of a tomboy really because I've got four brothers, three older, one younger, and I was a girl surrounded by boys, and I've got a very older sister and a very much younger sister. So I spent a lot of time sort of playing around with the boys, I think, but not in a sort of girl-boy way, but just being one of the lads. Then I went to St Bartholomew's Hospital in London to do my nursing training. And as I say, academically, it wasn't that difficult studying to be a nurse. I didn't really do any work because you just picked it up as you went along, I think. It was quite easy to understand the work that we had to do. Working on the wards, I liked the patients. I enjoyed being with people again. But it was about then that I did sort of begin to feel a bit frustrated that as nurses we didn't make the big decisions that doctors made. And reflecting now, maybe even then, I knew that I would probably go on and do other things than just being an ordinary nurse in a hospital. Yes. So when I finished nursing, I guess by then, after 3 years at Barts, although I liked Barts and it was a great hospital to have trained at, I was a bit disillusioned with just being a nurse. And so I decided I was going to go to university and get a degree, which everybody else that I'd been at school with had done. So I had a place to study French at King's College in London, and spent the summer sort of reading all the French books that you should do prior to starting a French literature degree. And knew I would love it, and knew I'd really enjoy it, but had this niggling feeling that it would probably be rather frivolous in a way, after having spent 3 years really seeing life and death as a student nurse, to then go back as a mature student to college with a whole load of 18-year-olds fresh out of school. Although I would have really loved it, because I did enjoy reading French literature and just the French culture and the way of life and the language, in fact, I just couldn't do it. So I'm not the sort of person to start something and then not finish it. And so at the last minute, I cancelled my place and I went on to train as a midwife at the Mother's Hospital in East London, which is in fact now closed. It was a hospital started by the Salvation Army in Victorian days, I believe, for the unmarried girls of the East End. And a great place to train, I felt, because it really emphasised basic midwifery. We learnt with our eyes, our ears, our hands, the very basic skills that a midwife needs to learn. I mean, obviously we had the machines and the technological advancements available at our fingertips, but we were very much taught how to listen to women, to look closely at them during their pregnancies, and to understand their background and the family from which they'd come. And it was a very good training school for anybody who wanted to go and work in the developing world, I think, because of the skills that it gave you. Because if you're out in the developing countries, you're not going to have the machines and the technological equipment that we've got here. So it was a good place, and I very, very much enjoyed my midwifery. So in a way that I hadn't enjoyed nursing, I suddenly found that being a midwife, you were a practitioner in your own right. And you could follow a woman's pregnancy right the way through, provided it was normal, to the delivery and home again afterwards. And that was a real joy and a real challenge. And I suddenly discovered something that nursing hadn't given me. So I was pleased. I was very happy at the Mother's. The Mother's Hospital then closed. And so I began to work in Tower Hamlets at the London Hospital in Whitechapel. And I became a community midwife, which meant that I delivered babies at home, visited women in their own homes before and afterwards, ran my own antenatal clinics, taught classes, parent craft classes as they're called now, and also taught students, student nurses, student midwives and medical students. We worked closely with the GPs, and in fact Tower Hamlets had a very progressive attitude towards home births, something which is not the case throughout the country. We'd probably do about one home birth a month, myself, and the other community midwives would do about the same. So it was quite a good rate, in fact. And again, the fulfilment as a midwife to deliver somebody's baby in their own home, in the presence of their own family, is indescribable, really. It was great. So I guess I got a bit sidetracked from thoughts of overseas work, but just because I enjoyed midwifery so much. But Tower Hamlets is very multicultural. You can't get away from the fact that there are a lot of people from different parts of the world living here, a lot of Bangladeshis, West Indians, some Turkish, Chinese, all sorts of people. So you are surrounded by folk. Then it came to the Gulf War, and after the Gulf War we all saw on our television screens the horror of the Kurdish refugees fleeing into the mountains in the bitterly, bitterly cold Iraqi winter, and the fact that Saddam Hussein was just not doing anything about them, I mean actively pursuing them into the mountains, and the fact that perhaps the rest of the world was not doing anything about them, just watching them on our TV screens. And I was horrified, I was really appalled. And at that time I was contacted by Tear Fund. Now Tear Fund is a Christian relief agency with whom I had once in my summer holidays spent 6 weeks working as a team of other young students painting a mission hospital in southwest Uganda. Now this had been a brief trip back to Uganda when I was 24 or something. Just for people who had a vague interest in maybe they'd like to work overseas one day and to see how they'd get on. And I loved it. And obviously Tear Funder thought I'd done okay, because they then contacted me four or five years later to ask if I would be available to go with a team to Kurdistan for 3 months to assist with the refugees. And I immediately thought, yes, of course.
Before you tell me more about that, when you look back, you know, do you think there were any other influences on you, you know, in this sort of desire to go overseas and do this sort of work?
Yes, I think there were many subtle ones. All of my family, particularly those of us, in fact, who were born overseas or who remembered living in Uganda, have had this desire to go back to Africa. My elder sister by this time was married and was living and working in Malawi with her husband. My older brother, I think, was in South Africa at this time. He's since married and he and his wife have been in Zambia. And my next up brother was in fact in Israel at the time of the Gulf War, and I do remember thinking a lot about him when the Scud missiles were flying over towards Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So all of the rest of my siblings have had interests in travel and work overseas, and my parents have been absolutely brilliant. They're so supportive, and that is a major factor which I perhaps don't emphasise enough, because I take it for granted. Now I meet people who say to me, how did your parents ever let you go, or didn't they mind, or didn't your mother worry incessantly where you were? And I suppose she must, because she's my mother and she loves me and she's like any other mother. But the brilliant thing about it is that she doesn't show me. And I'm learning now, in fact, from my sister, how much my mother worried when I was in Bosnia, which I shall talk about later on. And I feel quite sad that I had given no thought to how my parents must feel at all. Having said that, my mother, when we've talked about it, does say, but we did the same, because she and my father, as I say, went off to Uganda with a family of very small children and left her parents and my father's parents, you know, whisked away their grandchildren. And in many ways, the world was a much bigger place then. Distances were far greater. I mean, they sailed to Uganda, which took 3 weeks. We hop on a plane and we're there in 8 hours. And the same means you can come back just as quickly. And communication is so much simpler now. I mean, we have email, we have satellite telephones. You feel so much more in touch with people. But I've digressed, haven't I? Yes, there were other influences, as I say, my family. The people I've made friends with are people who are like-minded, people who also would like to travel and work overseas. And so it was constantly talked about, and I like reading travel books. I'm very interested in development in particularly East Africa, I think, because of my birthplace. I like meeting people from these parts of the world, or from all parts of the world. And I am a Christian, and I think my Christian perspectives on the world as well have been influential, because God made the whole world, and I don't think he just wants us to care for our small part of it. I think we have to take an active interest and participatory interest in what's going on everywhere. Yes, I've read a lot of books which have given me interests in the sort of work that I eventually gone on to do. And I do remember one book in particular reading, and that was Testament of Youth by Vera Brittain, and seeing it televised on the TV, which inspired me in many ways, I think, because she, like me, was a nurse. In fact, I think she spent some time at Barts, which is that added bit of interest. And at the time, obviously, I didn't know that I would work for the Red Cross or work in a war. But I remember reading that book with great enthusiasm and could hardly put it down. So I think, yes, it did guide me a little bit. But that's how we're led, isn't it? Often by things that grab our attention and things that enthuse us. are ways of showing us which direction our life should go, because it certainly wouldn't interest a lot of other people, and a lot of things that they do would not interest me. So little influences throughout your life sort of steer you in one direction.
So how about Drew, this really was your first trip, wasn't it? Your first big relief.
Kurdistan.
Yes, it was.
Yes. The painting the mission hospital wasn't a big trip, but it was enough to say, yes, I do want to do this sort of thing again.
But were you given any sort of preparation or training before you went? Was there time for that?
There was very little time. Because the situation was immediate. We had to go. So other than what we'd seen on the television and read in the papers, there was little prior preparation before we went. I knew it was going to be very, very, very cold. So I was quite concerned as to how I would function in extreme cold, without a hot meal and without the means to just get warm at the end of the day with a hot bath or sit by a radiator on open fire. Not just because it's pleasant to be warm and well fed, but because one's got a hard job to do, and you've got to be expected to put in many hours of work, and you need to keep yourself going somehow. So I was worried about that. In fact, as it turned out, we obviously were much, much better off than the vast majority of Kurdish refugees. Many of them were barefoot in the snow, and it got down to minus 20 degrees at night. So I certainly wasn't barefoot. I mean, even with no central heating, at least I'd been able to take, you know, thick warm socks and thermal underwear. And I do remember one article that I bought, which I've blessed. It was a fleecy jacket, which everybody wears these days for skiing or in the Arctic conditions we've had in Britain this winter. But in Kurdistan, that was absolutely essential. I wore it day and night, I can tell you.
How easy was it for you to actually leave your job, you know, get away? Were you given leave of absence?
Not at all, and that's a good question. I asked for leave of absence for 3 months, and as I say, I was working as a community midwife in a team, and the other five members of my team were only too happy to cover my work for 3 months, because they felt it was important what I was going to do, and they were all, like me, very concerned about what they saw on their TV screens, but weren't in a position to go themselves. Either they were married with young children, or they had husbands and older children at school. I mean, they couldn't go. I was young, free and single, and didn't have the same responsibilities and ties, so I could go. However, my manager in the NHS said no. And that shocked me, because I felt it was so narrow to only focus on the needs of the people in town. It's obviously they are needy, and it's an important job that we were doing here. But the world is wider, and one midwife missed here would not be very much, but one more midwife in Kurdistan at that time would have been invaluable. So I was surprised and shocked, and then somewhat angered, I think, by her response, and thought, what am I doing then, working here in this National Health Service, which at that time was getting perhaps a lower morale, and people were beginning to question a lot of things happening in the NHS. I thought, it's time to go, so I resigned. And that's really how my life has taken off, because I just made that one step of deciding that I was going to leave, just to go to Kurdistan for 3 months. What about the future? What was I going to do after that? Who was going to pay the bills, and how was the mortgage going to get paid? I didn't actually think about that at the time. I just knew what I was doing was right, and I had to do it. And I do believe that in a way I've been blessed in that, because I have never looked back. I have never had to go back to working in the NHS. And I have always had work. It hasn't been as well paid as a community midwifery sister has, but it's been infinitely more fulfilling. So I'm glad I did it.
So what else, you know, apart from warm clothing, did you feel it was essential to take? You know, what else did you pack for your own personal use?
Lots and lots of books. I love reading anyway. And very often, if you can't listen to music because you haven't got electricity or you haven't got any batteries or whatever, you can always read. All you need to read is a bit of light. and read by torchlight, candlelight, kerosene lamp, you name it, I've read by it. Probably not very good for my eyesight, but I read and read. So lots of books. I did, in fact, take a little Walkman to listen to music, but once the batteries were run out, I hadn't discovered rechargeables at that stage, I don't think. Once the batteries had run out, that was it. Music is something I really enjoy listening to, and I think it soothes me, and it's a way to unwind and relax at the end of the day. But if I had to choose, it would always be the books, because they can completely take you out of it, out of one situation in your mind into another.
So these would have been more novels, would they, rather than textbooks?
Certainly. I did take some textbooks because I felt I should, although I wasn't too sure which ones I would need. But novels, yes, I'll read anything, actually. I like historical novels, I like travel novels, I like all sorts of things. I do often tend to take the classics that I haven't read, because I often think that this is a good opportunity to get to grips with reading some of the Dickens and the Thomas Hardys that I've never really got round to reading. I think we're often so busy in our lives here, and it's much harder here to sit and read, because the telephone rings, or you've got to go out, or there's something else to do, and often long periods of undisturbed time abroad I can get through good heavy books. So I take a mixture. In fact, in Kurdistan I didn't read as much as I thought I was going to, and that's absolutely fine. I mean, it doesn't matter if the books sit there unread, but I thought that I would have a lot of long lonely evenings with nothing to do, but far from it, there was a lot going on. Was busy. I lived in a team there in Kurdistan. We shared a house with other people from the Tirfan team that I was in. We had two water and sanitation engineers, myself, a girl who was the administrator of our team, as it were, and a person who was working for UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So we were quite a disparate group. I was, as I say, I went as a midwife, and I was supposed to be setting up and continuing training of trainers programs for traditional birth attendants. Now, these are the Kurdish midwives who are not really trained and qualified as midwives, but they are the wise women in the village who would have traditionally always delivered the babies. And believe you me, they could teach me a thing or two. I'd hardly ever delivered a breech, because the doctors always do it in the UK, or twins, because that always gets all the doctors in. Yet these women had hands-on experience of a lot of difficult births, and they were women to be respected and revered. Although, obviously, there were things that I could teach them too. Things like the importance of sterility when cutting the cord using a razor blade, or a pair of scissors that had been boiled rather than a dirty pair, or a stick, which is what some of them would use, just the rough edge of a stick to cut the cord. So a lot of very simple things. Now, when the Kurds fled from their villages, which were destroyed by Saddam, they just went up into the mountains, higher and higher up, and of course the higher and higher they went, the colder and colder it got, until they were where I was, in the border between Iraq and Iran, high up in the mountains, so very cold, with about 6 foot of snow, and they were just living there in makeshift tents. The UNHCR had provided them with plastic sheeting, and with this plastic sheeting they'd created or recreated their homes as much as they could, pulled it round a few sticks or a few piles of stones, and created some kind of shelter from the elements. And the people that had been the midwives were totally separated. I mean, nobody knew where they were, is what I mean. That they were just with their families and making their living as best they could. But a woman who was pregnant or who was about to deliver wouldn't know where to find the midwife. So our job was to try to draw them all together, to sort of register their names and where they were, and arrange a training of trainers courses so that some of them could be trained up as trainers who could then train others. It wasn't me doing the teaching, which is how it should be, I think, in the developing world. I mean, this is how it should be. they have to teach their own people in their own language and with their own knowledge of their own culture, not what some Westerner from the developed world, particularly one who's not, you know, only 30 or so herself, coming to teach them to do. And some of these women were older than my mother. So it was difficult, but it was a good thing to be doing. There were a lot of obstacles, not least the weather, and the Kurdish authorities themselves, who were so full of bemoaning the fact that they were no longer a people, or not that they ever really were, but that they were just shunned by the West and hated by Saddam. And I think the authorities were often so caught up with their own political problems that they really didn't do very much to assist us in trying to help their people. But the individuals, the midwives concerned, the women who were pregnant, were absolutely wonderful and, you know, so thrilled and grateful for our assistance and cooperative in every way. So we organised these training groups, and actually they just sort of took off on their own once we had perhaps put the wheels into motion. I felt that everything happened by themselves, or they did it themselves, and that was great. That was really rewarding and encouraging. UNICEF were also working there, and they provided us with delivery kits which contained a pair of scissors and some sterile gloves, several pairs of sterile gloves, another thing which was important to use, and weighing scales to weigh the babies. Previously, I think the babies hadn't really been weighed, they would just sort of guess it. And one important other thing that we did establish, and I hope has been maintained, was birth records. There had been no real records before of when a baby was born, where a baby was born, who the baby was born to, particularly in the villages. In the towns, yes, babies that were born in the hospital, that was a bit different. But in the towns and right back in the outbacks, no, it just sort of happened and people knew, but there was no official record of it. And I think it is important that those things are maintained.
Mm-hmm. What was when you arrived, your first impression of the situation? You know, when you saw what you had to deal with?
I think my first impression has to be the overwhelming cold and snow. I couldn't comprehend that. I mean, I had been skiing and been in cold conditions, but we had to drive from Turkey into northern Iraq because we couldn't fly into Baghdad. I think we sort of came in the back door a bit, really, because a lot of aid wasn't particularly welcome, and so it was easier to come in through the northern part of Iraq with the Turkish border that was Kurdish controlled. And obviously we were welcomed by open arms by the Kurds, but not by the Iraqis. So we drove across, and we just seemed to be driving through snow in four-wheel drive vehicles, getting colder and colder. And the vast expanse of destroyed villages were what amazed me. Just saw piles of rubble, and that shocked me as to how total the devastation had been, total, that every village was razed to the ground, and you would drive through areas that were just nothingness until you'd get to a biggish town. So towns like Sulaymaniyah, where I was, Duhok, Kirkuk, they were just still there as towns, and then the village people, where their village had been destroyed, had flocked into the towns or into the highlands of the mountains. So destruction. As you got into the mountains, the numbers of people, just whole families, old aged men, young women, pregnant women, small children, babies, and like I said before, flimsily clad, not dressed for the cold at all, barefoot in the snow, cotton trousers and tunics, these big baggy trousers that they wear with the big wide cummerbunds, but no coat, no hat, no gloves, no scarves. So people who looked like they should be, you know, just in a hot climate or walked off the beach, but suddenly thrown into freezing temperatures.
Is that because of the difference, their homes and the, you know, going into a mountainous area? Would it have been, you know, would their home villages have been?
Right down in the valleys, it was a bit warmer. I don't know if it was a particularly severe winter or not. But it did snow even in the valleys, but nothing like the depth of snow up in the mountains, and nothing like the degree of cold.